This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. The death toll from an explosion outside a school in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, has risen to at least 58. That's according to Afghan officials on Sunday, with doctors struggling to provide medical care to at least 150 people who were injured. The bombing Saturday evening shook a Shiite Muslim religious neighborhood in Afghanistan, which has been targeted in the past by Islamic State militants, according to an expert there. Sudanese authorities have deported around three dozen Ethiopian peacekeepers working in the UN mission in Darfur to a refugee camp. Al-Fatah Ibrahim Mohammed, head of the refugee agency in North Darfur, says that the troops are among 120 Ethiopian forces from the Tigrayan ethnic group who have sought asylum in Sudan earlier this year. The troops refused to return to their home country, Ethiopia, for fear of being detained by the government. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has waged a devastating war in November on the regional government of Tigray. He has also swept up thousands of Tigrayans into detention centers across Ethiopia. The United States top infectious disease doctor says it was highly unlikely. Officials have been undercounting the number of fatalities from COVID-19 after a new report from the University of Washington estimated the death toll was nearly double. The analysis by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation pegs the U.S. death toll at more than 900,000. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Wednesday puts its latest official estimate at more than 575,000 deaths. This is VOA News. While the world's wealthier nations have stockpiled coronavirus vaccine for their citizens, many other poorer countries are still scrambling to secure doses. A few have yet to receive any. The World Health Organization says about a dozen countries, many of them in Africa, are still waiting to get vaccines. Those last in line on the continent, along with Chad or Burkina Faso, Burundi, Eritrea, and Tanzania. WHO says delays and shortages are driving African countries to slip further behind the rest of the world in a rollout of COVID-19 vaccines, with the continent accounting for only 1% of the vaccines administered worldwide so far. Criminal hackers are now using increasingly brazen methods to try to extort money from law enforcement agencies, including leaking or threatening to leak highly sensitive and potentially life-threatening information. The increasingly defiant attacks on law enforcement agencies underscore how little the criminal syndicates and operate ransomware gangs fear any repercussions. In Washington, D.C., a Russian-speaking ransomware syndicate called A book hacked it into the network of the city police department and threatened to leak the identities of the department's confidential informants. Experts say they had not seen such aggressive tactics used against police departments before. Mexican President Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador says that Mexico has complained to U.S. officials about their alleged financing for anti-corruption group that he said has engaged in political activity against his administration. He made the announcement at a news conference shortly before Friday's online meeting with U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris. The issue apparently did not arise at the meeting. However, that part made public focused on immigration, a key issue in the U.S.-Mexico relationship, along with trade, border security, and the pandemic. More than 1,200 migrants in decrepit, overcrowded fishing boats have reached a tiny island in a 12-hour span. Italian news reports say that the Coast Guard and Customs Police boat escorted the vessels to Lampedusa Island after they were spotted in the Mediterranean a few miles offshore. A newspaper in Sicily said that they arrived on wooden or metal boats. It said some of the migrants, most of the men, were from Bangladesh and Tunisia. Last spring, when weather was generally good, seen Libya-based migrant traffickers launch many unseaworthy vessels toward European shores. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. An Ethiopian opposition leader says a report about prison conditions in Oromia region does not go far enough.
It is short of details, probably avoiding some real sensitive issues about some of the killings and some of the detentions, but it is far better than in the past.
Chad's Transitional Military Council seeks support from its Central African neighbors. The United Nations says nearly 14,000 people in Madagascar are suffering from famine. Today is World Lupus Day. We'll have a report about lupus in Kenya. And South Sudan's president dissolves parliament.
The president has dissolved the parliament to face the way for the reconstitution of the parliament as it claims in the revitalized agreement or a solution of conflict that was signed on September 12th.
And refugees advocates in Malawi are alarmed over a decision by President Lazarus Chakwera. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ethiopian opposition leader says a report by the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission about the treatment of prisoners across the Oromia region is encouraging but does not go far enough. Merera Gudina, chair of the Oromia Federalist Congress, says Oromia is a very large region and it is possible that the commission investigators did not visit all the prisons. In a report posted on its Facebook page May 6, the commission said it believes that the conditions of prisoners detained at police stations amounted to grave violations of human rights. The commission said from November 2020 to January 12, 2021, it deployed monitoring teams at 21 selected police stations where a large number of prisoners arrested following the assassination of artist Hakailu Hundessa were being detained. The commission said detainees were held in unhygienic. The Oromia Attorney General's office said it investigated the matter and denied human rights violations. Gudina hopes that the commission will cover the entire region next time to document possible abuses.
It is short of details, especially some of the critical things, but it is far better than in the past.
What do you mean it is short of details?
Short of details and probably avoiding some real sensitive issues about some of the killings and some of the detentions, but in terms of solidity also in the limited areas, around 21 police stations. You know, Oromia is a very big chunk of land. It is not inclusive and short of details, but in the right direction.
Are you suggesting there are more disturbing details from these detention centers than has been reported by the commission?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
What are some of those concerns?
For example, you know, there are a lot of extrajudicial killings across Oromia. I'm not sure the report mentioned that. You know, Oromia is, you know, a very large chunk of land, and probably the so-called investigators or reporters of the Human Rights Commission is visiting a very limited area, 21 out of 50 million population. Oromia is having about 50 million population, you know, a very large chunk of land, and a lot of things happen in these areas.
So you believe that this report is the right step in the right direction?
Yeah, this is correct. We expect more, you know, more things from them. As an Egyptian institution in the claiming to be independent and neutral, really we want more of it, more detailed, more covering a lot of areas.
You know that the Oromia Attorney General has denied the Human Rights Commission report.
It is there for everybody to see. There's very massive human rights violations taking across the country.
What do you want to see happen because of this report? What should be done?
You know, one, follow-up, very lean, follow-up of the report to cover more areas and also to detain some of the things that are happening across the country, not only in Romania, across the country. You know, we are in a very serious problem.
Merera Gudina is chair of the Oromia Federalist Congress. He was speaking with us from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
A spokesperson for South Sudan President Salva Kiir says Saturday's dissolution of parliament is in line with the peace agreement. Atain Wek Atain says the agreement that ended the 2013 civil war calls for expanding parliament from 400 members to 550 to include members from all groups who signed the peace agreement.
The president has dissolved the parliament to pave the way for the reconstitution of the parliament as it came in the revitalized agreement or resolution of conflict that was signed on September 12, 2018, in order for the parliament to comprise of 550 members drawn from all the parties that signed the agreement, starting from the SPLM-IG, SPLM-IO, and the SAWA, as well as the OPP. So these are the components of the parliament. We are going now to be reconstituted, and the parliament will be appointed accordingly.
Where are we in terms of possible elections in South Sudan?
As we have seen, Julius Bati, the revitalized peace agreement is behind schedule, simply because the metric that was drawn in 2018 might not have been appropriately followed because of the challenges that are facing the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement on a solution of conflict. So we are running behind, which may require the parties to sit any time to decide what they should do, whether they will be going for the election as is scheduled or they will postpone it to 2023. Because if they are to go for 2022, the 2022 is only 7 months away from now, as I speak with you. And 7 months are not enough to conduct the census and to draw the constituencies that people will be going to contest the election. So these are the challenges that are facing the agreement. So I cannot definitely tell you about when the election would be conducted.
The last time you and I, we spoke, we talked about also implementation on the unified South Sudan military.
Yes.
Where are we on that?
That's why I'm saying the challenges I see enormous. I told you last time that as we are still undergoing armed embargo, it will make it difficult for the revitalized national unity government to graduate the unified forces because they don't have guns. The training is still also ongoing. Like national security has just taken the unified national security forces to the training, which is undergoing now. It might take months or several weeks before you complete unifying the national security forces. The national army forces are also, some of them are still also under threat. And the question has come whether we will be having guns to graduate them. If they don't have guns, we will look for a new name.
Was all this delay a deliberate attempt? Or, I mean, some people may argue that this was deliberate on the part of your government, the president, just to delay the process so as to remain in power.
No. The blame actually should be directed to the international community who want us to walk, but they are actually putting their head on our legs. We cannot move because we are being tied down. This is the problem. If we are allowed to move, then why imposing an armed embargo? And the agreement stipulates that a national army has to be drawn from all the parties and must be inclusively trained in order to take over the security sector in the country. So it is like you are telling person to person to walk and you are tying his or her feet down.
It's always very nice to talk with you, sir. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Atain Wek Atain is spokesperson for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He was speaking with us in the South Sudan capital, Juba. Envoys from Chad's Transitional Military Council are seeking support from its Central African neighbors in fighting rebels who, it said, endanger a smooth transition to civilian rule. Chad's delegation told Cameroon's president that without peace, transition to civilian rule would be impossible. But Chad's opposition says the military rulers should immediately step down if they genuinely want peace. Moki Edwin Kizika reports from Yaoundé, the latest stopover for the Chadian envoys.
Abdelkerim Idriss Deby, Deputy Director of Cabinet of the Republic of Chad, held discussions for close to 2 hours with Cameroon President Paul Biya Friday. Abdelkerim is a son of Chad's late President Idriss Deby. He says Cameroon is one of the 5 Central African states Chad's Transitional Military Council asked him to visit and give an account of the situation since Deby died on April 2021.
Comme vous le savez, le Tchad a vécu une tragédie, le départ prématuré du feu maréchal au front.
He says Chad has been witnessing a series of protests and deadly rebel attacks that are threatening its unity since Deby died. He says Chad's Transitional Military Council has sent him to all member states of the Central African Economic and Monetary Community to explain plans the military leaders have for a smooth transition to civilian rule. He says Chad needs the assistance of its neighbors for peace to return. When asked, Abdelkerim declined to comment on the type of assistance his country needs. He, however, said security will be threatened in the region and spill over to all Central African states should the situation in Chad remain fragile. A rebel force known as the Front for Change and Concord in Chad, or FACT, has been involved in bloody battles with Chadian troops on the Central African states' northern borders with Libya, Niger, and Sudan. Chad said several hundred troops, rebels, and civilians have been killed within a month. Chad, under Deby, was a key ally of France in the fight against jihadist groups across West Africa, including Boko Haram. These terror groups and other jihadist militants have, over the years, destabilized parts of Chad, Cameroon, Nigeria, and Niger. Joseph Vincent Tuda Ebode is a lecturer in international security and defense at the University of Yaoundé Soa. He said Chad's envoys are visiting Central African nations to lobby for the kind of support the former president of Chad had from his neighbors all through his 30 years rule.
Le Cameroun doit se sentir concerné au premier plan. D'abord parce que nous sommes liés dans une alliance.
He says Chad's late president Deby and Cameroon president Paul Biya signed an agreement to assist each other in maintaining security in both countries and in providing support against attacks. He said Chad's Transitional Military Council wants to maintain the agreement signed between Cameroon and Chad. He says the terms of the agreement between the countries are clear. An attack on Chad is synonymous with an attack on Cameroon and vice versa. Massa Success is a Chadian opposition leader of the Transformers movement. He says although there are serious threats to stability, civilians do not want Chad's constitution violated. He says the Transitional Military Council is not showing signs of wanting to hand over to a civilian rule. He spoke via telephone from Chad.
Il parle de 18 mois renouvelables. Si on crée encore une situation de sécurité, on va dire, ah, mais on voulait...
Massa says the charter presented to Chadians by the Transitional Military Council states that the military rulers can renew their mandate of 18 months if insecurity persists. He says a national dialogue should be convened and a civilian designated to lead the transitional period while the military carries out its duty of maintaining peace. Massa said any civilian chosen to lead the transition should not be a candidate at the presidential election. He said Cameroon, Gabon, Central African Republic, Equatorial Guinea and Congo-Brazzaville should help bring peace by advising Chad's military to hand power to civilians. Currently, Chad's Transitional Military Council is headed by Idriss Deby's 37-year-old son, Mohamed Idriss Deby. Mohamed was named interim head of state by the council after his father, who spent more than 3 decades in power and was one of Africa's longest-serving leaders, was killed fighting rebels at the age of 68. Mohamed promised to hold elections within 18 months, but the opposition and rebels dismissed the takeover as a coup and said the military must relinquish power to a civilian-led government. Thousands were on the streets to protest military rule. The demonstrators said they do not support what they called a Deby monarchy. The rebel group FACT has vowed to depose the Transitional Military Council should it fail to hand over power to civilian rule. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, May 10th. The United Nations says nearly 14,000 people in Madagascar are suffering from famine, while more than 1 million others are facing acute hunger and forced to resort to extreme measures to keep from starving. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
More than 1.1 million people in southern Madagascar are unable to feed themselves because the country is suffering from its most acute drought in four decades. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs warns the humanitarian crisis gripping the country is deteriorating rapidly. OCHA spokesman Jens Lajerke says conditions in the Amoasari Atsimo district are particularly serious. About 75% of the population is facing severe hunger, and nearly 14,000 people, he says, are catastrophically food insecure.
We have, during this crisis, for the first time, identified 14,000 people who are in famine condition. Now, children are, of course, especially vulnerable. There are extreme malnutrition, and as we have heard from others, there is no doubt that the level that this has reached now is costing lives among children and others.
Aid agencies say the number of children admitted for treatment for life-threatening severe acute malnutrition in the first quarter of this year was four times the five-year average. That condition causes wasting, stunting, and can lead to problems of physical and cognitive development. Lajerke says the United Nations is in desperate need of money to stave off a looming catastrophe. He says the UN is renewing an appeal for $76 million, which was launched in January. He says only 22% of the funds have been received. He says that amount falls far short of what is needed to provide life-saving support for more than 1 million people.
The amount of money that it's asking, 76 million, is not a lot of money. It frankly is not in the bigger picture. And now there is really an opportunity for donors to step up with a modest amount of money and save lives from one day to the other.
Lajerke warns, however, time is running out fast for people in Madagascar, especially for children. He says there's no time to waste. International donors must give money to support this life-saving effort, and they must give now. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today is World Lupus Day, and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, says more than 5 million people have been affected by the disease worldwide. The CDC says 70% of the patients have systematic lupus, a condition that affects vital body organs such as the heart, lungs, kidneys, and the brain. As Marie Ojiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, doctors say lupus is difficult to diagnose, which makes it a life-threatening disease.
According to the Center for Disease Control, CDC, systemic lupus is the most common type of lupus, affecting 70% of patients with lupus in Kenya. Most patients get late diagnosis since the society believes the condition is a curse, hence delayed treatment. There is no cure for lupus, but medical interventions and lifestyle changes can help control it. A Kenyan, Jemima Shikuku, was diagnosed with lupus on May 10, 2018, on the Lupus Day. This is after the doctor's efforts to treat her body rash, inflammation, and severe headache did not bear fruits.
There was a misdiagnosis at first. I was told to go get checked my eyesight because they thought probably it was the one which was causing the headache. Before my diagnosis, with the chronic headache, I had a lot of inflammation of the joints and the skin. I also had muscle weaknesses. I've really had a lot of challenges with the lupus, like physical stress.
World Lupus Day increases awareness of lupus and helps gather support for the more than 5 million people affected by this condition worldwide. Jemima says there is need to create awareness in Kenya and other African countries.
There's really a need to create awareness in Africa, especially on lupus, because it's really misunderstood. Like when I was sick, I remember some people could come and ask me if I wronged someone. Some people can tell you you're bewitched.
Another Kenyan, Ocholo Ratego, lost his sister to lupus in 2016 after battling the condition for nearly 10 years. Multiple organ failure made his sister Winnie Ratego succumb to the condition while on treatment in India.
We were promised that at India she could get that medical attention that she deserves and things could get better for her. She was then assigned to go for a second checkup. But unfortunately, on the day of traveling, when they landed in New Delhi, she got really, really sick at the airport. From there, those 3 weeks that she spent in India doing a second checkup, the body organs were failing to function normally. On June 16th, she passed on.
Dr. Etau Ekwom, a rheumatologist from Kenyatta National Hospital in Kenya, says lupus is a very difficult disease to diagnose given its rare condition.
Lupus is a difficult diagnosis to make, and therefore the delay in diagnosis, because usually to make a certain diagnosis, one requires to have had certain symptoms over a duration of time, and that may delay the diagnosis. It's not only in Africa or Kenya where lupus diagnosis is late. It's a phenomenon recognized globally, and one usually would require a high index of suspicion in the diagnosis.
Dr. Etau says laboratory support is needed in Kenya to support the patients living with lupus.
Patients who will die from lupus usually will die because they have severe complications of lupus. Complications that include kidney involvement. One of the challenges at the initial phase of this COVID-19 was the lack of availability of hydroxychloroquine. The other challenge, of course, is laboratory support.
Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
Now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the draws for the Toto Women's African Cup of Nations Morocco 2022 qualifiers scheduled for today at the CAF headquarters in Cairo, Egypt. The Toto Women's African Cup of Nations Morocco 2022 will pit the continent's finest women's football teams against each other in Morocco. The Toto Women's AFCON is also a qualifier for the FIFA Women's World Cup Australia New Zealand 2023. Also on Monday, CAF will conduct two more draws. African qualifiers for the FIFA Under-17 Women's World Cup India 2022 and the FIFA Under-20 Women's World Cup Costa Rica 2022. Staying with CAF, reactions have continued to trail the decision of the Confederation of African Football in consultation with the world governing body FIFA to postpone the CAF qualifiers for the 2022 FIFA World Cup slated for Qatar. The first set of matches in the qualification competition were due to be played in June, but the postponement came after taking into consideration the current challenges caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. There will now be double match days in September, October and November, with the 10 group winners advancing to the final round next March. Jide Alabi is a football analyst. He tells me that there are lots of positives African national football teams can take away from the shift in dates.
It's going to be a plus for the team because that means they're going to play much more matches together, which is a very good thing for me. If it were to be the usual schedule and you don't have this kind of cramped situation, then you can talk like that. But right now, any opportunity for you to play football is good for your team.
Jide Alabi speaks further on why this decision was taken, even though the African continent is not as worse hit with COVID-19 as Europe, South America, or the United States.
In Africa, it's always very difficult, especially with the crisis all over so many parts of Africa right now. Africa has a unique problem which affects football and every other thing in Africa.
In boxing news, Senegalese-born Frenchman Souleymane Sissoko on Saturday won the WBA Super Welterweight title at the AT&T Arena in Arlington, Texas. Souleymane Sissoko had to overcome a ninth-round knockdown before sealing a split-decision win over Kieran Conway. The Frenchman took a knee after an uppercut from the Northampton fighter, but gained victory with scores of 96-93 and 95-94, while the third judge scored it 97-92 to Conway.
Together, we worked very hard for the training camp. We had a good training camp, so I'm very happy. And, you know, I can't wait to defend my belt right now.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good day. That's it for this Monday, May 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.